Hi, Kevin Van Meter. Welcome to KABU.
Thank you, Bill. Really glad to be here with you today.
Kevin Van Meter is a writer, scholar, wrote the book Guerrillas of Desire, Notes on the Everyday Resistance and Organizing to Make a Revolution Possible. Kevin Van Meter is also an activist, and he works as an organizer, building consciousness and building forces that might transform this country and the planet. So, Kevin, you, among many others who identify as anarchists and a considerable number of Marxists and some left liberals who want to democratize all of life, you're all challenging those who contend that capitalism has been largely successful in domesticating workers, that working class radicalism has been vanquished, that we have to look to others to challenge the capitalist conquerors and the pillagers. You challenge that, reply to that based on your examinations of everyday life and the work that most people do. And what you see, multiple types of resistance that can be the beginning of the springboard for building the kind of movements we need for transforming this country. In this interview, we'll conclude discussing how to organize to build those understandings and commitments. First, though, give us some examples of worker resistance.
So I think there's a range of activities that we could talk about under resistance. Some of those might be highly organized, right? Labor unions, protest activities. But in addition to those activities, there are many, many, many forms of resistance that people utilize in their everyday lives and, of course, at their workplaces in order to create more time for themselves, to create bonds with their fellow workers and the like. So specifically, I'm talking about forms of activity that take place outside the stated political above-ground organizations. That can take many forms, and I've looked at it historically in slave societies, peasant societies, and then what we call both the industrial and then the social factory, so the social service sector, in addition to the industrial factory. And these forms can take many, many different guises. So, for instance, we could look at theft at the workplace, which is a major problem for employers. And we could think about how gig workers and social service workers cooperate on the job in order to make that particular job class or set of tasks less oppressive and allow themselves time to pee. There's an old adage that the boss makes a dollar, I make a dime, and that's why I poop on company time. And these little moments actually can accumulate, circulate, amplify one another, and lead to more organized forms of resistance.
Yeah, I have the sense that there's all sorts of ways that people try and do jobs really well and really rebel when they know that the job they're doing is shoddy and they're just producing shoddy things, like in Bill Watson's famous essay, Counterplanning on the Shop Floor.
Right. Bill Watson is an interesting figure. As a young man in 1968, he entered the auto factories of Detroit in the Midwest and discovered that outside of the quote-unquote official organizations of the left, that is the political party, the union, nonprofit organization, right, and of course nonprofits develop later, but all those official organizations of the left that supposedly represent workers' interests, but also outside the command of management and the managerial system, Watson was able to see how many forms of organization and cooperation were actually taking place on the shop floor. And that took place in a number of different ways. So for instance, workers would play, right? There was a hose on the factory floor. And then when management and supervisors were not present, they'd spray each other with a hose and take a few moments of themselves to carve out from the workday to have some free joy and expression. Additionally, and I think this really gets to the counterplanning question, is that management has a very particular way through Taylorist and Fordist mechanisms and the factory floor in kitchens and households, on street corners, wherever work is being performed in order to command that work in the most efficient fashion, right? Moments are profit. Marx outlined quite clearly in Capital Volume 1 that there are three separate ways in which work is imposed and surplus value is created. That's by extending the workday, that's by increasing production through technological usage and hydrocarbons and energy, and then the third is just the intensity of work. And through counterplanning, workers actually address all three of these mechanisms, right? They can decrease the intensity of work by cooperating with one another. They can very often sabotage those machines of production that are being implemented in order to decrease their need in the production process. They can simply steal away moments as that workday is endlessly expanded. And one of the things we've seen with the rise and development of neoliberalism and an entrepreneurial culture and a nonprofit culture over the last 40 years is, in fact, that the workday is extended into all hours of life, right? The only time we are free at work in fact, is when we're unconscious, sleeping. So workers are very often counter-planning, that is, creating different plans outside of the realms of which work is being imposed specifically in a work site. And I think one of the other things I hinted at there in my comment was that the work site is not just simply the factory floor, as Watson outlines. It's also not simply, as I've tried to show in Guerrillas of Desire, both the fields of slaves and peasants is a work site at which massive amounts of resistance take place. But actually, in fact, one of the most important aspects of the last 40, 50 years is the development of the wages for housework movement in 1972. So Watson wrote his essay in 68, published it in 61, and in 1965, Silvia Federici, a feminist scholar, wrote Counterplanning from the Kitchen, of which they looked at the same kind of counterplanning activities that were taking place in Watson's essay in the homes, in the home economic realm of housewives and others. And I think what's important to note here is capitalism requires two base commodities to function. Both of them are energy-based. The first is hydrocarbons, the use of coal, gas, wood, et cetera, in order to use various technological processes to produce more output per hour of worker effort. The other is the energy of labor power. What is being reproduced in the home, in schools, society in general, is labor power. That is the worker's capacity to work. There is no more important commodity for capitalism than labor power. So as Federici and others have noted, when counterplanning takes place in the home, in sites of social reproduction, which is still to this day, even after 50 years of feminist struggle, work that is predominantly performed by women and trans folks, gender nonconforming folks, those outside of the gender binary, are performing this work, and as a direct result, are having a form of work that's imposed upon them that is unwaged. So actually, in fact, if we see labor power as not only a commodity, but a base and one of the most important, if not the most important commodity for the capitalist mode of production and capital accumulation, then interfering, counterplanning in that reproduction of labor power is a key site of struggle. So what that has opened up is to see working class struggle, not just at wage work, but in all that unwaged work.
This is KBOO Radio, Portland, Oregon, volunteer-powered, listener-supported. Bill Resnick today talking to Kevin Van Meter, an organizer, an activist, a writer. We've been discussing popular resistance by what he has called in his books the commoners and their constant struggle with employers, sometimes just grumbling, sometimes a bit of untraceable sabotage, sometimes cheating a bit, sometimes listening to music, organizing, making requests, demands. Kevin, what's the role of the organizer? What happens to people themselves as the struggle goes on? Because the organizer cannot just herd people at the point of a gun into a room and teach them to repeat the revolutionary catechism. I mean, get concrete on the role of the organizer.
I think there's a lot to be said here. So I want to take a quick step back into the kind of everyday forms of resistance or working class self-activities, various different traditions, anarchist, Marxist, and others, which call attention to this kind of activity that takes place in everyday life. And what I see there is a relationship between spontaneity and organization. Usually on the radical and revolutionary left here in the United States, we see these as dichotomies, right? That you want spontaneity or you want organization. In my view and in the view of the book, I see this activity as actually commingling. And the reason for that is traditionally the difference between medicine and poison was dosage, right? With spontaneity and organization, you need different levels and different dosing of those in a particular context, in a particular work site, in a particular struggle, in order to achieve your goals, right? One of the criticisms made of the labor left here in the United States is that it's commanded by bureaucrats or particular sector of leaders and prevents working class self-activity and spontaneity from taking place, right? By actually doing that, and I believe that that does take place, and I see that in the labor movement currently, it prevents the engagement of workers and other forms of struggle from emerging. Additionally, if you have nothing but spontaneous activity with no coordinated organizing, you can't accomplish certain things. The kind of example that I used to give 10 years ago was info shops, right? If you want to rent a community space and sell books or give out information or have a gathering space, and you try to organize that in a spontaneous fashion, one individual might put their name on the lease for 5 years, rent that space, but there's no organization to keep that place going. Additionally, very often left and radical organizers believe they know what's best or the best form of organization, a political collective, an affinity group, a syndicalist union for a particular form of struggle, and then are surprised that no one joins that organization. There's a reason why most left formulations, left organizations in the United States today have barely a dozen members. And the reason for that is it's not connecting with the everyday lives and the everyday struggles of people themselves. So I think we have to be cognizant of how much organization we need to accomplish our goals. We want to be cognizant of how much spontaneity we need to organize our goals. And we need to do that through collective processes of organizing. And really, the organizer's role there is accompaniment, an accomplice, a facilitator, someone who can provide some historical context and the like in order to help that spontaneity find channels and avenues of action. And of course, part and parcel of revolutionary struggle over the last 500 years is, in fact, finding those strategies and struggles that are successful in the context in which they're operating, and then circulating those lessons to other contexts where they might apply. So, for instance, to go back to the spontaneity organization argument for a second, you don't want an affinity group that is confronting the police to be highly overly organized in such a sense of which there is a command structure waiting for instructions for those spontaneous actors to go out there and confront the police, push back the police line and the like, right? Clearly, there's a form of spontaneity that's needed there, but then organizing and defending those who are arrested by the cops in such an action to do court support, to do legal support, is a different set of strategies of which we need to implement. And it's the hope, it's my hope, that organizers not only seize the roles of these various kind of activities, but also provides an historical lens for those who are engaged in those activities, because it's quite difficult to organize after folks are arrested to get legal support and legal funds and the like. In fact, we should be engaged in creating base building operations of which spontaneous struggles that might emerge can be supported by. I think there's another really good recent example, and that's the Black Lives Matter movement. For the last 20 years, really for the last 50 years, there's been a growing development discourse and organizing around police and prison abolition. That has seeded ideas all across the left, especially in communities of color, across the United States. And then as that struggle emerged, we're able to take those discourses and that organizing and further their own struggle, right? We cannot predict various kinds of struggle that are going to be emerging, even though I would argue we want to be reading struggles that are emerging. And if we are paying attention to new struggles that are emerging, very often they take forms which we might not necessarily recognize. And it's important that we are attuned to those struggles that are emerging as organizers, as writers, as people who are involved in revolutionary struggle. And I think it also means that we challenge ourselves as organizers to have those difficult conversations. There's a difference between labor organizing and community organizing or radical left organizing, where you're attracting people to your cause, your ideology, or your organization. The difference with labor organizing is it's the boss who's organized the workforce, and it's up to us to deal with each and every individual at that work site or in that workforce in order to engage them in a larger process, either of collective bargaining or striking or taking direct action on the job. And our challenge as organizers is to go beyond our comfort zones in order to find what motivates and drives people, and not just motivate and drives them, but what kind of activities are they engaged in. So I think people are complicated. I don't give a lot of credence to class consciousness as a concept. I'm more interested in how people are organized vis-a-vis capital and the state apparatus, that level of power, and how those things circulate. And I think consciousness is a difficult avenue. And then to point to a particular historical example that will really draw this out, I want to call attention to wartime strikes that took place in the World War II here in the United States. And specifically, the best book on the subject is Marty Glaberman's Wartime Strikes. In the factories that were producing tanks, guns, bullets, et cetera, for the war effort, the unions and the workers themselves were signing no strike pledges, saying that during the war effort, they would not go on strike. And then their wages fell, and then they all went on strike massively. So the same individual individuals that would wear American flag pin, that signed a no-strike pledge, actually engaged in some of the largest strike activity ever in U.S. history. Now, this stuff is complicated, and the reason it's complicated is because consciousness and people are complicated. So even those who are good, patriotic, white Americans engaged working-class men in these factories that were signing no-strike pledges and then going on strike, they were also striking to keep particular populations out of the factory and maintain their centralized control over that production process and that union process. And that was excluding people of color, immigrants, women, and others. So these wartime strikes that are taking place are immensely complicated because consciousness is complicated, and why we might want to honor and support and further the struggle to strike against low wages, even when someone has signed a no-strike clause, and especially when someone's signed a no-strike clause. We want to make sure we're looking at those struggles and how they're furthering the liberation of all.
Kevin, you get the last word, but let me make a semi-provocation. It seems to me that a good organizer can, in fact, bring people to a set of appreciations that underlie any kind of transformatory project. But I think it's sort of incumbent on the organizer to somehow push along that kind of democratic organization of the workers so that they begin appreciating one another's capacities. Anyway, that's my provocation. You get the last word.
Thank you, Bill. And I think that's a good one, right? In my perspective, power educates, right? Labor organizers will often say the boss is the best organizer, especially when the boss is doing something terrible, unjust, claiming poverty and pulling up in a Rolls Royce. So I want to give an example from my own organizing background. Spent some time over the last few months supporting a bargaining team. On the bargaining team, there were two individuals. One was very conservative, biker, supported timber unity, and leans pretty hard right. Another bargaining team member is a queer woman, engaged currently to a trans woman, and is very out about those kind of experiences and struggles and the importance of supporting queer workers at this particular workplace. These are two individuals that are ideologically opposed, who very often would not have engaging conversation, but working together on that bargaining team, they're now confronting power and being educated in the fact that they have more in common as low-wage workers at this particular workplace than they have with the boss itself, right? Or with white supremacist ideology or the gender binary or patriarchal systems. That actually, in fact, that power has educated them in that confrontation with power about their common needs. And I think those are important moments of which we need to help support and facilitate, because we're not going to convince people by a strong argument, by a meme, by a post, by a well-crafted argument or insult. We're going to change the power relationships by organizing to build power among the working class people of various backgrounds, and then confronting the power of the boss at the work site, the husband at the home, et cetera, et cetera.
Kevin Van Meter, keep up the good work. Check out Kevin's website and his books. Why don't you give them the information, Kevin?
Certainly. My book from 2017 is called Guerrillas of Desire, Notes on Everyday Resistance and Organizing to Make a Revolution Possible. It's available from akpress.com. And my personal website is readingstruggles.info. And Reading Struggles is the title of the book that I'm currently working on now. And I look forward to sharing that with you, Bill, and your listeners.
Right. Thanks a lot. Let's talk again.
Thank you. And I look forward to those conversations.
America.